No.
He's just a boy. Just a sweet little boy.
Franklin, pick up the phone.
He's just a sweet little
pick up the phone.
Just a sweet little boy. That's what boys do.
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve a birthday present, but hopefully not a bow. Oh. Or arrows.
One's useless without the other, so you could give you a bow.
I think you can kind of go at it with arrows.
Maybe not the arrows.
If you can't see this, I'm doing the psycho. Oh, goodness. All right, well... This week, our title film is Lynn Ramsey's 2011 psychological horror domestic nightmare. We need to talk about Kevin.
Yes, we do.
After her son Kevin commits a horrific act, troubled mother Eva reflects on her complicated relationship with her disturbed son as he grew from a toddler into a teenager. Okay, that's a fair synopsis.
Yeah, it does quite a few things in between growing, but yeah.
Yeah.
But I think toddler to a teenager, that's pretty universal. We can all relate. We've all done that.
I relate to Kevin.
Because you grew
from a toddler into a teenager.
To a teenager. Yeah. You missed the middle stage.
For no other reason.
Joining us this week as our very special guest is our esteemed producer, Jade, of End Credits fame.
End Credits fame. That's what I'm known for now. That's my job. I'm not.
You're in the end credits.
Introduce myself at all anymore. You're twice before. Yeah.
No, but... We mention you every week as esteemed producer Jade in the end credits.
I know, and it's very nice of you. Thanks for doing that. Every time I listen, I go, oh.
But right now, what we need to talk about is Kevin.
Bruno.
Yes,
Kevin.
Kevin. Anyway, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I would say pretty emphatic thumbs up, albeit with some reservations.
Yeah, thumbs up. I've seen all of Lynn Ramsey's 4 features. This was the first one I saw years ago. This was my second rewatch. Yeah, while I still prefer earlier films that she made in Britain, Kevin definitely gets a thumbs up for me. She still has another miss.
Just to clarify, we need to talk about Kevin. The film gets a thumbs up. The character Kevin gets a big thumbs down.
Yes.
He's rude.
He's more than rude, I would argue.
I think he's very rude.
Yeah, I would also give it a thumbs up, yeah.
We like this film.
It's engaging. It's interesting.
So, normally it's the two of us doing the introduction to a title pick, but I feel like, Jade, you chose this title pick for us, didn't you?
I did, yes. Mostly because we were going to do a different film, and I couldn't find an alternative pick for
a much less depressing film. We're going to do Notting Hill, and we're doing this. Which, you know, isn't what a lot of people would call a natural progression.
I mean, I would say for me it's a natural progression, because recently I've been going down a bit of a rabbit hole of very psychological, like, you know, films that involve sociopaths and stuff.
We'll save the rabbit talk for Celia.
Oh, good.
This is all about hamsters. Were they guinea pigs?
Is it a guinea pig or a hamster?
It is a guinea pig.
It's a guinea pig, my bad.
Oh, that's a sad moment in the film.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Sorry, cut you off. Would you say that your taste has, like, extremes of very cushy and cuddly and very dark and twisted?
Yeah, probably. That's probably exactly the stuff that I like. It's either absolutely fucked up or it's like just cozy trash. And I love it. And I couldn't find anything for Notting Hill, so here we are. Before we get any further into talking about We Need to Talk About Kevin, I think it's worth mentioning for anyone who isn't aware of the plot of the film that there are quite a lot of triggering topics that we'll be discussing in detail. Obviously, as this is the title film, we're assuming that most people have watched it. And therefore, we won't be fussed about spoilers.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, there will be topics of, a school shooting. There is assault involved. There is quite visceral death.
And lots of other stuff which
psychological abuse,
emotional
harassment,
emotional manipulation. So if anything like that isn't your cup of tea, or you'd rather just avoid because it's one of those days, skip ahead and we'll put a timestamp.
Or,
because the other films
are going to be pretty triggering, pick a nicer episode. Yeah. We've got loads.
That's a valid point. Maybe just skip this episode if you're having a bad day.
Yeah.
Just
go and watch, listen to Brokeback Mountain. That's quite a happy episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for quite a tragic film, it's one of our most upbeat episodes.
Yeah, pretty jolly episode. So try that one.
So, we all liked We Need to Talk About Kevin. What did we like about it?
I liked visual language was extremely striking. The use of the colour red in particular was, I think, so ingeniously deployed. I think Tilda Swinton's performance was fantastic. I think everyone's performance is great, but she really holds it together and is able to play a very sympathetic character without compromising the things that would make that character unlikable. And I think it's such a tight balancing act to walk, especially for a female character, even in 2011, I was just totally blown away by her performance, as I am with all her performances. The truth is, I shouldn't be surprised when Tilda Swinton turns in an amazing performance, because she's an amazing actor. But every time she does something subtly different, and I am just in love with her all over again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I really like about this film, and this extends to the whole of Lynn Ramsey's oeuvre, but how it is so entrenched in an individual perspective that Tilda Swinton's character, and we're really experiencing the world of the film through her senses, through her body. Stuff like the non-chronological editing, the non-linear editing, where we go back to her memories, you know, very far away, and then we jump back to the present, and it's very like, yeah, and it's very erratic like that. It really mimics the way that she's experiencing these conflicting memories about the acts that her, you know, son has committed near the chronological end of the film, before the beginning of the narrative. But also, I speak about a sensorial affect, because the way that Lynn Ramsey shoots her scenes is always so haptic, so very up close and personal to the characters. We really get to feel their tactile sensations, and we get to smell the things they smell. There are so many sequences where you see Kevin having these like bodily tics, and then his mom mimicking them, like, you know, biting fingernails or rolling up balls of dough. And those are always filmed this extreme close-up that really heightens texture of the image and everything like that. So I just think Lynn Ramsey is a master at conveying physical experience on film.
No, I think to sort of jump off your point about the chronology of it, I think it's also very intelligently plotted. I felt that the pace throughout is beautiful, because there are these lovely quiet moments where you are just with Tilda Swinton, you're seeing her experience in the present day and how the legacy that her son has left is just continually impacting her. And then you go back to the more kind of heightened moments of Kevin's upbringing and how they've clashed throughout the years. And I think any moment where it feels like it's getting too slow, it picks up the pace, and vice versa, when you feel like you've experienced quite a lot in one period of time, it brings it back down again. And I think that's what makes it, in an age where I find it quite easy to pick up my phone and like check my phone when I'm watching a film, because, you know, that's what our brains are trained to do now. I'm pretty sure I was locked into this film from start to finish.
Yeah, I agree. I think the pacing that you mentioned is super, and it's superbly edited. I think little things just like the hairstyle being different, or the colour palette being different, you never doubt whether you're in the sort of real-time present day or whether you're in her perspectives, memories.
I mean, how much Tilda Swinton smiles is a pretty good indicator of whether it's pre or post incident.
Pre or post Kevin in general.
Pre or post Kevin, yeah.
But it's not post Kevin, because unfortunately Kevin is the only surviving family she has.
Oh.
Poor Celia.
Oh God, no. Honestly, I actually think we might have talked about this off mic, that you guys knew what happened at the end before you watched it. I didn't. I had somehow managed to avoid the spoiler.
You hadn't seen the film before you picked it?
No, I had, but I'd seen it about a week before I picked it.
The reason
it was front of mind is because I literally watched it a week before we had this discussion.
Gotcha.
And that's why I was like, oh, let's do this one. And I didn't know the ending. I had managed to avoid the spoilers altogether, and I figured out what was going to happen in terms of the shooting. What I hadn't figured out is that his family were going to also be involved. So I thought that was that. And then when she went into the empty house at the end, my heart just went, oh no.
So you've only seen it once, right?
I rewatched clips for the episode, but obviously I'd only seen it like a week and a half.
So do you remember what the first shot of the film is?
Yeah, it's the curtain, isn't
it's a slow pan onto the curtain.
And I saw it when it came back. I went, no.
But re-watching the film, having seen it again, just having the opening shot there, after years of having seen it the first time, it would just send chills down my spine because I knew what it was about.
I do think something that it does very well, which I don't know if I see that often of a film before a certain relatively recent time period, which is a mother who just doesn't have the natural mother's instinct. I mean, it kind of develops with Celia later, but definitely initially, even before Kevin started to show his weird-ass tendencies as a kid. Like, she doesn't have the nurturing instinct. She doesn't have that mother's bond with him. She doesn't take that much interest or patience with him, and that's not to her detriment. He's an annoying child, but to portray that as kind of very, very sympathetic, but at the same time maintain all of those elements, because the traditional mother's role is supposed to be kind of that caring, nurturing bond with her child, like to subvert that, but at the same time still make her a sympathetic character and still show all of the intricacies of her relationship with Kevin, I think is quite unique.
I also think that she's very much not supported by Franklin.
Oh, absolutely.
So not only does she not have a natural mother's instinct, that's not complemented by a partner that has a more naturally parental temperament. Because even though he does, he's very absent in certain periods of her life. And you assume it's because he's working, but even when he's home, he will constantly take the child's side over his wife. And I think that's it's very, very distressing to watch that he is so willing to spoil and coddle this child at the expense of his wife's well-being when she's saying, look, I have a problem and I need help with this, or I need you to just listen to me. He will constantly take this toddler's side. And that's, he passes it off as a very normal thing. And I'm sure a lot of parents have had to deal with this, but that is on paper, that is an insane thing to do.
So, I don't think John C. Reilly's character is particularly malicious or is even shown to be an abusive or horrible husband.
No.
He's kind of an everyman type of character, and I think that's his biggest flaw, because in the average upper-class American household, the dads get to be the fun parent, the one who takes them out, the one who's, you know, always on their side, and they don't the one who never has to say no and never has to take any responsibility or take charge. So I think in that sense, the two of them are a very typical couple, but obviously in this particular situation where their child is a psychopath, that is exacerbated to an extreme.
Yeah, I think that just before Celia loses the use of her eye, I think from Franklin's perspective, he has the perfect life because he doesn't look at what's happening right under his nose. He's like, oh, I've got this nuclear family, I've got this son who's like my firstborn, my boy, and I've got this adorable girl, and I've got a marriage, we're still together. And the fact that when it becomes so unavoidable that there's something going on he has to deal with, talking about the total breakdown in relationship between Eva and Kevin, but also Celia's disability, his instinct is to just get a divorce, to end it. And I think that's really interesting that rather than trying to fix it or trying to get therapy, rather than get any sort of solution, it's to go to the most drastic thing because that means he is still in control.
Yeah, I think at that point it's also framed as he's tired of his wife allegedly blaming Kevin for everything. And when she blames him for this horrific act of violence, he snaps and he's like, no, I'm not going to take this anymore, which is more a symptom of his inattentiveness and just general.
I would say more than just inattentiveness, it's also, and this thing I do completely understand from a human level, who would want to admit that their own child is capable of the things that your partner is accusing them of? There is an element of willful ignorance, because what parent is going to turn around and say, oh, my son's deliberately mutilated my daughter to a permanent disability? Great news! Not that he'd ever say that, but do you know what I mean? Like, there's an element of deliberately pulling wool over his eyes so he doesn't have to face the truth, and there's an element of that that's sympathetic, but to it's having such a detriment on Eva, so Tilda Swinton's character's mental health, and the fact that she is so many times maintained what she's seen and what she's experienced with Kevin to him, that it gets to a point where you're saying, actually, this is just selfish.
I mean, that's the point of the title. The two of them never actually talk about Kevin, and they should.
Yeah, and part of that is because at a certain point, Kevin has stopped her from talking about him,
yeah.
Which it's one thing not to want to admit that your son has these problems and that he is a danger to others.
Mm.
It is another thing, and sadly not that uncommon a thing, to decide that instead of admitting that, my version of the story is going to be that my wife is negligent, that my wife is...
hysterical.
Hysterical. That's exactly the word.
And there's all the hysteria and the womb and all of that. All of that stuff.
Yeah, it's so...
it's all intertwined.
It is. Just to talk about this scene that I alluded to before, it takes place after Kevin, who is not really a toddler anymore. He's more of...
it's like five.
I think the point being that he's not old. Yeah. He's too old to still be wearing...
I was thinking, does that still make you a toddler? I don't really understand when you stop being a toddler. That's more my thing. But he isn't toilet trained at this point, and he should have been, and so she is still changing him like he was a baby. And he has begun to weaponize that because he knows that it upsets her and is a disgusting thing to do. He's old enough to realize that changing your growing child is a very unpleasant feeling, and so he uses it to mess with her, even at that age. And she gets so frustrated that she throws him.
But like, to give a bit of a background to that moment, it is later shown that clearly Kevin is purposely avoiding using the toilet. Like, no, is simply not potty trained. He fully knows how to use a toilet. He chooses not to in order to be a nuisance. And this is after he, as a baby, like, as a literal newborn child, is shown to almost purposely wail and cry 24/7 when he's near his mother, but then shut up when he's near his father. And a pattern of said behaviors, which is interesting because it almost shows an inherent malice in Kevin, even as a baby. But at the same time, the fact that the film is framed through such an individual perspective of the mother's point of view, we are seeing this through very selective memories. So it almost feels like she's going down a reel of everything bad that happened between her and Kevin, almost like she's trying to find fault within herself for the act that he committed.
What I find really interesting about that interpretation, we talked a bit about this while I was watching it. You seem to think that we are meant to question whether she is a reliable narrator, and the film is inviting you into that conversation, whether it comes down hard or not. And I think that's a really interesting thing, because Eva spends so much of the film not being believed about the things that she's seen. And the forced perspective of this film and forcing you to enter into that makes the audience complicit. And I just think that is such a genius move to tell this story, that just like Franklin and just like everybody, we are doubting Eva's memories and testimony.
The thing that I find so interesting though about that is, I completely agree and it's absolutely fascinating to watch, but then the reason that by the end of the film I'm not questioning the reliability of her narration is because the fact of him going into a school with a bow and arrow and with pre-planning, so it's not a mental break. It's, you see him buy the lock for the school door in advance. You see him do all of these preparations, so you know it's not like a snap in his stability. It's a premeditated act. The fact that all of that has happened, and by the end, you know that's a fact because her husband, you know, Franklin's dead, Celia's dead, everyone hates her. For me, that can't have come from nowhere because of that premeditated element. And so I believe all of these things that she says she's seen and she narrates back to us, because in my head, she's just knitting together a story of things she's seen.
I should clarify, I don't think the narration is unreliable. I think what I meant was more a subjective point of view and a select point of view, more so than a point of view which might be lying to us. Because we need to think about where Eva is at the end of the chronological narrative, after Kevin has committed the shooting and has been arrested. She is the only surviving member of her family, so she has no network of support. She's been blamed by everyone in her town. All the parents of the dead teenagers are fully blaming her and bullying her and harassing her on the street. And she's in this position where it's never explicitly said by the film, but she's probably questioning, was he born like that? Or did I make him like that? Which is what you would wonder as a mother if your son did something of that kind.
Absolutely.
Do you think the film wants you to think that what is wrong with Kevin and caused him to do these things is a real-life affliction? Or do you interpret Kevin as something other than human?
Where I thought you were going to go with that question.
I don't mean that he is literally like a supernatural demon, although that is kind of where I'm going with this. This isn't like a tinfoil hat thing. My point being that is Kevin, if not Kevin personally, is his evil something beyond medical explanation? Because like you said, he instinctively cries with Eva. As a child, he is far more intelligent in how to manipulate people than even someone that you could describe as a psychopath would be at that age. It's much more of a movie version of psychopathy.
Yeah.
So is the evil transcendent of any real world explanation, and it's just this child exists to torment this woman and ruin her life? Or do you think the film is purporting that there is something diagnosable about Kevin?
I think that you actually explained it yourself right there, because basically I think Kevin's character overlaps with a lot of ideas that we have about psychopathy or narcissistic tendencies, etc. He expresses a lot of those, but I don't think that he is written to be a case study for a psychology or medical textbook. And down to the fact that, you know, even as a little baby, like, that makes it very unrealistic from a medical perspective. But I think this is all part of a broader, I don't want to call it agenda of the film, just a broader tendency of the film to deal with very, very sensitive topics, but avoiding any correlation to real life events that are similar. Down to the fact that, you know, he performs a school shooting with a bow and arrow. He never expresses any ideology, you know, whereas, you know, with a lot of cases of mass shootings, especially in the States, you can always point it down to, oh, they were radicalized by a certain, you know, group, or they've read certain literature. In this case with Kevin, we're purposely never given a reason other than his, you know, inherent evilness.
So something we haven't mentioned is that this is based on a 2003 novel by Lionel Shriver. Mm-hmm. And what Shriver does, she basically has it be much more political and real world than the film does. And the film is, I don't think it's apolitical, but I think it is less interested in hard and fast real world American politics, which isn't surprising since Lynn Ramsey is Scottish. A lot of it is set during the 2000 presidential election. And Franklin is much more conservative and explicitly Republican in the book, and Eva being a Democrat. There's a lot more kind of allegory there. And Kevin, as a character, chooses to use a bow because he doesn't want his acts to be appropriated into a gun control debate. I don't think it's that he is a right wing, even though he might be. The reason is he wants what he does and the atrocities he commits to be significant and not washed away by a larger debate.
I was going to say, it sounds like more of a narcissistic thing than it is political state.
I totally agree. So many shootings happen, but so few happen with a bow. It's almost, look at me, this requires actual skill in how I murder people, as opposed to anyone who can just open fire from stuff they got at a gun show.
Because that's the thing, like, there's almost like the opposite error in looking at this film as being not about guns, that some people might read it as feeding into the stereotype of, oh, it's not about gun control, because see, you can commit the same type of crime with any kind of weapon, which is a line that conservatives and pro-gun people use a lot. And again, because the film, we need to talk about Kevin, is not trying to make a political statement, he's not commenting on this, but in the real world, if you have a bow and arrow versus a gun, the death toll is going to be very, very different, objectively, although obviously neither situations are ideal.
Do you think there's anything Eva could have done differently that could have averted at least some of this atrocity?
Objectively, when she found that Kevin had killed the pet guinea pig, there is absolutely a reason to report a child or an adolescent to the police, because harming animals is, you know, a telltale sign that next they're going to move on to harming humans. So I think that's the only point where she could have made a decision to stop him, but I think by then she was already too broken mentally to act.
But there's nothing that she could have done to stop Kevin developing the way that he did, in your interpretation of it?
In the way that the film is framed, no.
I'm inclined to agree with you on that. What about you, Jade?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, the film very much leans harder on the nature than nurture, I would say. And it also leans into, she tries her best to intervene at points, but can't. Mm-hmm. Whether that's because of her own kind of broken will or because she's not believed or for whatever, or he has a hold over her, which he does at points. The one thing I would say is, like, just get rid of the bow and arrow. At some point you think he shouldn't have that deadly weapon. And I'm not saying that that's on her because he could just go out and buy another one. But when they were messing around with it in the garden, I was like, dear God, just someone get rid of that. But put it in the bin.
But I know even he would go out and buy another one. His dad would buy him another one. Like, he would go and want to his dad, the mum, throw away my bow, and he would get another one.
I know.
Like, as a matter of fact, he does.
Does he?
He gets him a bow when he's younger, and he gets him an upgrade.
Yeah. And then he upgrades it to a death machine.
And then he gets him. I swear, he gets him another one after that.
Yeah, yeah. Really? He keeps upgrading.
He upgrades to a premium bow after that, and that's
always from the dad. And very, very briefly on the subject of the politics of the book. Now, while the film doesn't make an explicit political statement, there is a line by Franklin. This film is made in 2011, but when Kevin buys the bike locks and he says, "I'm gonna resell them," and Franklin says, make a killing. And Franklin goes, "Oh, like Donald Trump," who at the time wasn't a political figure, but he was certainly a right wing figure, or at least, you know, a representative of a certain type of politics. Whereas with Eva, we get a sense from her flashbacks and the type of job that she does that she used to be a traveler. She's a, you know, well learned person. She's probably someone who leans more liberal just in terms of her, like, personal interests and, you know, her job.
All right, so availability. This movie is available to stream on Netflix, Mubi, and Curzon. You can rent it on Amazon, Google Play, Chili, YouTube, Apple TV Plus, Sky Store, BFI Player, and Curzon. And you can buy it on all those platforms other than Curzon and BFI Player.
So, is it time to move on to our next pick?
I believe it is.
Okay, our next pick is going to be poetry. Play the trailer.
Sir, 저 갈게요. 빨래하고 청소하고 할 일 다 했어요. 그러게요. 내가 시를 왜 배울까요? 굉장히 기분이 좋았고. 왜 그랬어? 어? 왜 그랬어?
'Poetry', a 2010 film directed by Korean director Lee Chan-dong. Grandmother Mi-ja works part-time as a caretaker and struggles to raise a teen grandson, Wook, by herself. Enrolling in a poetry class, she endeavors to capture life in verse form, but her simple dream of completing a poem is stalled by the early sign of Alzheimer's disease and the heavy financial and emotional burden of her grandson's shocking wrongdoing. So, before we get into the film itself, I should add a bit of a warning at the beginning here. This film deals with themes of rape and suicide. There is no explicit showing of these acts, and so I don't think that our discussion is going to include any descriptions of such events. So if the mention of these things can potentially trigger you, you can skip 20 minutes or so ahead to the next section. Otherwise, there's not going to be any descriptions of any details whatsoever.
In a way that Kevin would approve, this is a very trigger-heavy episode. Yeah.
But why did I pick this film? Because, like, the synopsis doesn't mention what the wrongdoing is. So the backstory behind this film is that the director Lee Chan-dong was quite emotionally shaken by an actual real-life event that happened in 2004 in a rural town in South Korea, where a group of middle school boys had sexually assaulted a girl in their class. And this event left him particularly shaken to the point where he was haunted by the idea of putting it to film, but obviously couldn't find a way of representing this on the screen. And eventually, when he was in Tokyo for a trip, I think, and on Japanese TV, he saw this, like, TV program that was just, like, shots of nature with, like, a mellow sentimental music on top. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to make a film named Poetry, and I'm going to make it about that. So that was kind of the impetus of the film. So that the aesthetic is much closer to the natural documentary that he was watching than it is to something like We Need to Talk About Kevin. But the crime that Mi-ja's grandson commits is the fictionalized version of that rape, where in the film it is a series of sexual assaults that continues for months and months on end until the girl commits suicide. So yeah, that's all of the triggers taken care of. That now let's talk about the film.
That's not really a spoiler, because what interested me is that isn't a twist. It gets revealed really early in the film that's what's happened, and that was the dead body that you see at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. It's also like, spoiler or not, impossible to talk about this film like an episode without addressing.
I totally agree. Yeah. Because it's also, it hangs over the entire film. It's not something that the film builds to.
I mean, it's functionally the inciting incident, right? More so than the poetry class or the dementia.
Some of the horrifying, albeit in a kind of muted documentary manner, elements of the film are people's reactions to that event. A lot of the unsettling, pervasive...
Do you want to describe exactly what happens? Because I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, there are multiple instances that I'm thinking of.
Well, I'm thinking mostly about the circle of dads.
Yes,
right,
that's exactly what was my first thought.
Those fucking, I hate those dads.
Yeah, just trash men. So essentially, one of the big plot drivers of this film, Mija, who is the grandmother of one of the boys involved in the sexual assault.
And essentially a single parent
who is basically working a part-time cleaner job. She's not that financially stable, as you find out near the beginning. She's brought into a conversation with five other parental figures of the five other boys that were involved in this act, who are all the dads in this instance, but she was brought in because she's a single parent figure. And their concern is not so much shock over what happened, although they do make a point of saying, oh, terrible stuff. But their real concern is the future of their boys and their future not being ruined. And how can we get enough money together to get a settlement for the mother of this girl who has committed suicide so that she won't tell anyone?
Yeah. And they are in cahoots with the school board and the local police to hush everything down.
And the local paper.
And the local paper, yeah.
And it's mostly male figures that are trying to hush it down.
Absolutely. And I think it's only a gender critique, because crucially, Mija is the only woman in this group, and she's the one who's clearly, like, so vulnerable, and she's being dragged into this.
And she's sent to talk to the other only significant female character in the story.
Yeah, mother. In order to move her emotionally. But it's also a class critique, because the girl who dies, she's the daughter of a farmer, and she's very working class. Whereas what we can garner from all the dads outside of Mija, all the boys come from quite bourgeois upper class families.
I think anything of dropping the money.
No, exactly. But they still put Mija through the ringer because she can't procure the money, which is, I'm now seeing, 5 million won
each
for a total of 30 million, which equates to roughly £3,000 per person. So yeah. This film, like Kevin, is explicitly political. It's fair to say that, down to the you know real life event it's been inspired from.
£3,000 times by six. That means they're putting a child's life and mental destruction by a continuous act of gang violence at £18,000.
Yes, which the mother of the girl, I'm sure that would kind of be life-changing money for her, but it's certainly much less than what she, you know,
lost.
What she should be owed.
That also reflects their view of her.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, they know that she's a farmer. They know that it would be a life-changing amount of money for her. But as far as they're concerned, you get the sense they could pay more. And one thing I would bring up, because I don't know what you think about this, but other than the one dad who she has slightly longer interactions with, because she asks him to loan her the money, and he basically says, I don't have the money, I can't afford it. And I wasn't sure whether or not that was genuine.
I think you can read it either way. I think that my read on that character is that he is the worst of the five, because I think he is the one that is most likely to believe that he is a good and decent person. And when it's actually put to him to step up and help another person, he doesn't. And I think that even if it's not intentional, I think it is more in line with what the film is saying about these structures that protect the perpetrators of violence over the victims, if he is read as being just as bad as the others, if not worse, because he is walking around with this veneer of niceness.
And the other main reason why I picked this for Kevin is the perspective of the film, very individual perspective of Mija, the grandmother. And, you know, we need to talk about her for a minute, because she is, I don't know, this film emotionally crushes me every time. Unlike maybe you could argue, you know, Eva and Kevin, she's a completely blameless individual. She is someone who, you know, has very simple pleasures, very simple drives, and it does seem like everything in the world is slowly piling up against her. Again, this film is incredibly tragic, you know. Melodramatic is an understatement for this film, not because of the style in which it's made, which is very subdued, but just because of the very little amount of hopefulness that it leaves for the central character. Everything that happens is compounded with the other two central themes of the film, which are the poetry and the dementia, or in other words, the loss of memory. Mija, throughout the film, is shown attempting to recount her own life to other people who just plain dismiss her or don't listen to her. And she feels like she has probably very little time to live, very little time to tell her story, but she's being ripped away from it. And the way that the poetry class is constructed is that the teacher seems to always tell them to, gaze, daily, mundane things in the world, and really look at them and really explore their texture and the way that they're built, and you're going to be able to find poetry and you're going to be able to find beauty in everyday life. But she's completely unable to do this. And in fact, the moments when she writes down little verses in her journal happen to be the moments at which she's at her lowest. I think the very, very first time we see her writing anything is right after she hears the news about her grandson. Mm-hmm. She walks out of the room and writes a little line about a flower.
Bits of the sadder aspects of her life are bleeding into the poetry.
Yeah.
So when she describes those flowers when she leaves the room, she describes them as red like blood. And then when she's going to visit the girl's mother and she stops and looks up at a tree and she writes a couple of lines, I think it's something like the apricots crushed underfoot or trampled or throwing themselves to the ground to be trampled or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So even though she is finding beauty in words in mm-hmm. her lowest moments, unlike the poetry teacher where he's saying find beautiful things to write about and write mm-hmm. these beautiful lines, she is putting that layer of sadness and darkness mm-hmm. over the poetry that she writes. I think that's more meaningful, that those things that she writes about, they are beautiful, but they are dark.
I think what she's trying to do is she's trying to bring the simplicity that her teacher is asking her to add to the paper, but that what she actually wants to write about are her deeper emotions.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's going back a bit now, but I was going to I was going to disagree. Your characterization of it is very little room for hope. I think what is extremely tragic about it is that there is room for hope. There is room for hope that she can find some meaning through poetry. And what is so devastating is that that hope is there. The hope is dangled in front of her, but that she is unable to access it without the successive traumas that are happening in her life mm-hmm. at that time affecting it. So even the thing that was meant to be her escape from what was, even pre-incident, a pretty demanding, if not depressing, life, that's robbed of her too.
I think something that does bring her joy are her childhood memories. It does really seem like there was a time when she was happier and that time is long gone. She's constantly reminiscing and constantly talking about when she was younger, and it constantly falls on deaf ears. And that is escaping from her quite explicitly, and all that's left is the present, and the present is full of these tragic tragedies.
The doctor makes it very explicit that forgetting nouns is the first step of dementia, and this is when she's trying to nouns and then verbs,
yeah.
And it's just as she picks up the poetry class, yeah. Where I would say nouns and verbs are relatively key to writing poetry. So I feel like I did also think in that moment when it was introduced, I went, oh, that's gotta be another kind of projected sadness when you found something that you're really enjoying, but you know that it will soon become inaccessible to you.
And also, she never tells anyone that she's been diagnosed with dementia.
Yeah.
So she's constantly telling everybody about how great of a relationship she has with her daughter, Wook's mother, who's off in Busan doing, her own girl boss shit. But when she gets diagnosed, she calls her daughter and she's like, oh yeah, the doctor said I'm fine. I just need to do more exercise. So whenever anyone asks her why she's taking a poetry class, she always gives some sort of a dismissing, I was interested in it, I was curious about it type of answer. But it might well be that internally she's trying to grasp to something that she knows she's about to lose.
I just think that the memory theme is successfully conveyed in the opening scene in the hospital where she describes having memory loss. And I think from the context of her age and the way she talks about it and the way the doctor reacts, the audience can put two and two together rather than introduce it as this thread that, from a linear narrative perspective, and I understand thematically it's very important, doesn't have any catharsis.
I do have another thing that I found quite hopeless about the film.
Hit us with it,
Jade. If we want to keep it light and cheerful.
Oh yeah, that's us.
The fact that Wook, so her grandson, who is part of the group of boys who commits the sexual assault, is such a kind of average teenager, that honestly probably horrified me more so than watching when you talk about Kevin, because as we said, there's this veneer of Hollywood over Kevin and he's this weird evil being that even as a child was horrible. This is just a kind of
idiot
teenager who's kind of rude, but insofar as teenage boys can be rude, to his grandmother, and watches a lot of TV and eats junk food and hangs out with his friends, but has committed this horrific act, and it makes me feel really hopeless watching it. Because
also, he's young.
These aren't like 18-year-olds or anything like that. They're like 15.
I think he actually looks the age that Kevin is meant to be.
Yes, absolutely.
I think they're meant to be younger because they're middle school, so they're probably 13, 14.
Yeah.
All the characters involved.
I'm so glad you said that, Jake, because I was thinking the exact same thing, that because he is committing an evil act as part of this group, the way that his personal evil is conveyed is so banal that it is more terrifying. And for someone that is so common and still unpleasant, still obviously rude, commit these horrible acts, I agree, it is so disgusting to watch.
The bit that really cut me to the core, more than all of these little everyday things that shows the kind of disrespect and general teenagery angst he has towards his grandma, is when she almost reaches a point internally where her emotions pour out and she goes into his bedroom and he's just kind of lying on his bed. I don't know if he's trying to sleep or sulking. What do the teenage boys do? I don't know.
Brooding.
I was never one. And she starts shaking him and trying to pull his duvet off him, saying like, why did you do it? She never says anything other than it. Mm-hmm. But she says, why did you do it? Why? Talk to me. Just say something. Why? And all he does is kind of, just as if she's saying, like, you haven't done the dishes, you haven't cleaned up after yourself, you haven't done this. He just kind of, does without saying anything, just shrugs her off, like pulls the duvet over himself. And his reaction, directly contrasting with her emotional response to this, is terrifying, because she's literally, it's the first time she's properly let these emotions out. Mm. And she's literally clawing at him, and it's really hard to watch. And he just shrugs it off as if she's saying, do the dishes, and he's like, I don't want to.
Onto this theme of words that we were talking about before, I think it's so significant that I don't think she ever says, my grandson raped this girl. She never says it in as many words as that. She never says it with that directness. She finds a way to communicate it by the end, but that's part of her journey. It's being able to comprehend the evil that was done to this innocent girl.
Again, by the end, it's clear that she has an affinity with this girl, and I think it's probably due to how much harm has been done to her throughout her life that she ends up finding more of a kindred spirit in this girl she's never met, just due to the suffering that she's endured than she does in her own grandson. But I do think that one similarity with Kevin, in terms of the boys who committed the crime, is that we can surmise by the way that their dads act, that these are all boys who are not really thought empathy or not really thought the consequences of their own actions, because once again, they committed something that no human being in their right mind would ever dream of committing, and their parents are just trying to hush it and, you know, hide it under the rug. And with Wook, he's the only one in the group who comes from a working class background, because he's the only one whose grandma can't pay for the, settlement. Still, they all, you're right, the banality of evil, it's a group mentality, but also almost like in this case, I think the evil is very much nurture more so than nature.
Here's an interesting question that we probably don't really have an answer to, but with what you were saying then about Wook being an anomaly around his friends, and I would say has been given some restrictions on his life. I mean, one of the first things we see is his grandma saying, I'm not buying you a new phone, like you only got the last one last year, like why do you treat things like that? Or, you know, you can't go out and do this or pick up your rubbish. You know, she is still disciplining bullying him, even if it's a light touch, whereas the other boys, it feels like they're just very quite spoiled and allowed to roam free. But in which case, how does that make work in comparison to his friends with this act? Is he going along with them because he wants to be part of the group? Or does that bring into question if it is more nature than nurture because he's had a different upbringing to the rest of them?
I don't think the film answers that question, no. But there is certainly something about group mentality here and herd mentality. Mm.
What's extremely haunting is that when you see him with his friends, they all look very similar. They all act, none of them have discernible qualities as characters that makes any of them stick out from each other. You get the sense of this sort of homogenous group of teenage boys going out like droogs in Clockwork Orange and doing this, and I think that kind of makes it more scary.
Well, I also do think it speaks to the fact that when you are a teenager, the most important thing in the world is fitting in. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing in the world is your group of friends. And, you know, I remember being 15 and something would happen that makes me feel like I'm not as cool as everyone else or whatever. And it's like the worst thing that's ever happened to you. So the fact that they all kind of feel the same and they, you know, they come in the door and all say like, hi, mom, when they're all coming around Oak's house, that feeling of like teenagers are quite often very similar at that age because you're all trying to fit in and be cool, and that's terrifying that in that instance being cool and fitting in involves such a horrendous act.
You mentioned that when he's leaving stuff on the ground, he's disciplined in a way that you don't imagine they are. I got the sense that they had help in the home, the sort that his grandmother provides.
Yeah, probably.
Because she works in a much more middle-class home.
I know it's interesting, but the place where she works, I think that's too big of a tangent to get into now, but you know, she's a caretaker for this man who suffered a stroke, and he's implied to be incredibly wealthy. So although I think his flat itself is not particularly glamorous, he's like this older guy with a lot and a lot of savings. So again, that's another class dynamic there.
I think that topic's too big to get into.
Yeah, because so much stuff happens.
Huge kind of work.
No.
So it's a bit of a, it's a bit of a spoiler.
But watch the film if you want to
sad.
So, generally speaking, I felt a lot of sadness, a lot of grief, I actually felt a bit of loss at the end of this film, actually. Because you do become, you become invested in all the different aspects of Mija's life. So when it comes to an end, there is a feeling of, like, general sadness for just how the is. For the plot and how her life is and has played out.
I think, like, we need to talk about Kevin. I think the use of perspective is so efficiently done that it's used as a tool that you are in this character's head so convincingly. I think that, in my opinion, it's the greatest achievement of the film. And of Kevin as well, that you are just very into this protagonist's point of view throughout the whole thing, and you feel things as they do. You never feel like an observer, you feel like a participant.
There is almost also a parallel in the chronology piece. I know that it is chronological. I know that poetry does follow a series of events chronologically, but she visits places from past events. So she visits the river, which is the girl at the beginning is found in the river. She visits the classroom that the she's told that the sexual abuse has played out in. I mean, she goes into her grandson's room and tries to look through his stuff, I guess, to find clues about what's happened, about the past. And even though in We Need to Talk About Kevin, you actually do see the past play out as Eva is trying to piece together what led to this moment, you do still actually get that with Mija. She is still going through the past.
She goes to the girl's funeral.
Wow, my brain glitched then.
From the top.
She goes to the girl's funeral and she almost tries to piece her together as a person. She takes a photo of her and she is going through and tracking back this really tragic chronology in a similar way that Eva does.
Because, again, unlike Eva, she doesn't have access to Wook's experience and Wook's childhood.
She's looking for answers.
Yeah, exactly. Also because she couldn't be present for, you know, Wook's life because she has to work. And it's very tragic like that, that she's almost like retroactively trying to piece together the puzzle. But yeah, that is a very, very interesting connection that I hadn't even thought about.
Availability for poetry. It is only available to buy on Apple TV Plus.
And also you can buy the DVD, which I think the UK version comes around at like £9. So same price that you would pay for most pay-per-view streaming services. Now, shall we move on to the next film?
Yes, we shall.
Through the long grass, creep, creep, creeping came the hobbyists. Skip, skip, skipping on the ends of their toes ran the hobbyars. And the hobbyars cried, pull down the hemp stalks, eat up the little old man, carry off the little old woman. Then little dog Turpy ran out barking loudly. The hobbyars were afraid and ran home as fast as they could go. But the little old man awoke and cried, little dog Turpy barks so loud that I cannot slumber nor sleep. In the morning I will take off his tail. So the little old man took off little dog Turpy's tail to stop him from barking. That night, along came the hobbyars.
Celia is a 1989 film directed by Ann Turner. Shaken by the death of her beloved grandmother, Celia finds herself adrift between the cruel games and rituals of childhood and the incomprehensible world of grown-ups, with monstrous creatures stalking her dreams by night, those imagined terrors blur by day with the banal brutality of the adult world and lead to tragic and shocking consequences. I think that's a very well-written synopsis by Letterboxd.
Celia is based. She's not evil. That's all I say about her.
Celia's not evil. Does it say she's evil?
No, but we're talking about evil children.
That's true.
Yeah. And the subtitle of the film, the original release, is Celia the Demon Child, Evil Child, something like
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah.
You're
I think that's unfair.
You're wrong, because... But it's worth keeping
it's not the original release.
It's not the original, it's the American release. Celia American. Child of Terror.
Celia Child of Terror.
Was the American release.
Yeah.
The other thing worth mentioning about this film is that it was made for 1.4 million Australian dollars and made 23,336 Australian dollars. This movie was not a success when it came out, but it sort of endured to become a cult classic and rediscovered for all the things that are good about it. I really enjoyed this film, and I found it a really interesting take on how environment shapes development. Mm. I said Celia isn't an evil child. I think Stephanie is.
Stephanie is a horrible little child who has been pampered by a parent who is an authority figure and needs someone to tell her, go to your room with no dinner, you horrible little child.
Stephanie, Kevin, and Wook are all very rude.
Yeah, rude.
They're just rude.
Yeah.
All of them, it's horrible. They're just rude. That's the worst thing about them.
And Charlie, you mentioned you haven't seen The Spirit of the Beehive, but I kept thinking about that film when I was watching this, because The Spirit of the Beehive is 1973. It's a Spanish film where very similar setting, kind of like rural Spanish town, where there's these two little girls and one of them is obsessed with Frankenstein and starts developing fantasies around the Frankenstein monster. And it was the main inspiration for Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, which is another film that's very close to this.
I do see the Pan's Labyrinth connection. I think the hobbyars would be fun to hang out with, and I think the symbolism of them is kind of confusing because they seem like the good guys in the folktale.
Do they?
Yeah, because they... Don't they punish a animal abuser?
No, but they take away his, like, wife and child.
He keeps killing the dog.
No,
yeah,
but he's only... I think you're getting... I don't think it's a chicken and egg debate. He's not doing anything to the dog the hobbyers appear.
No, he keeps barking, so he cuts off his tail.
Yeah, but he's barking at the hobbyers.
then he gets annoyed at the dog.
Yeah, but I'm not defending the
just
fact...
Just move!
I'm so, not defending that, but I'm saying that the hobbyers aren't coming for him because he's an animal abuser.
I think that the hobbyers are devils in the literal sense, in that they are a force of punishment. They're not...
I just think they'd be a fun hang.
A fun what?
A fun hang.
Oh, right. Well, Charlie, you know what? Each to their own.
Just some weird Scottish blue devils. It's from Scottish mythology originally, I think.
I think
Yeah. Oh, that's why I travelled to Australia. That makes sense.
Well, Celia is the name of Eva and Franklin's second child.
Yeah.
We need to talk about Kevin. And she is the name of the main character in this movie. So, coincidence?
She's lived a couple of lives.
I really like Celia as a character. I think that the way that she has so much empathy for the people around her in a world that not only is unempathetic, but punishes empathy.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And we should say this film is set in Australia in the 1950s during a period of Red Scare, seemingly parallel to the communist witch hunts happening in America. And viewing that from a child's point of view as, on the one hand, she really wants a pet rabbit, and then the government decide no one can have a pet rabbit. Then the government decide no one can have a rabbit because they're an invasive species. Her rabbit's taken away from her, and you're not allowed to be friends with these kids because their parents a communist, even though they're much nicer than all the other kids.
Yeah.
Especially the daughter of the fascist policeman.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, in the nature versus nurture debate, this film clearly, like, whatever, you know, evilness or terrorness she might have within her, it's really her acting up to authority and disobeying rules. But she, you know, Celia is an empathetic child. She is a good-willing child. She's not someone who has any form of evil intent. So whatever evil she commits is projected on her by the adults around her who want to maintain this, you know, conservative hegemony and control over, you know, all the children in the neighborhood.
I also think that one of the things this film does so well is the way that it communicates how cruelty and violence is taught. The fact that they're in an environment where people own guns, for example, and how that teaches you what behaviors are acceptable and unacceptable in a very toxic cycle. The way that it's up to everyone, but particularly adults, to break the cycle, I think. When Evan has the chance to really stick it to Celia's father over how he's essentially ruined his livelihood and forced him to have to move, he turns the other...
And flirted with his wife.
Well, exactly. He turns the other cheek because he is choosing to break a cycle of cruelty in a way that every other character seems to be perpetuating it. Every other male character, I should say.
No, I agree. And I also think it's really telling how all of the childhood, I say games, there's a lot of like bullying going on, but it is portrayed a lot of the time in game form because it's kind of two groups of children against each other, and they will play out like in the quarry, they play out these kind of war scenes and they're shouting like, get the reds. And you can literally see the mirroring of the fact that a lot of their parents would have gone to war previously. That's kind of one of the plot points, is Celia's father. The impression I got was he served in the military with Stephanie's father, who's the fascist.
No, they're brothers.
Are they brothers?
He called Uncle John. Yeah, that.
I thought it was
Stephanie's
like
her cousin.
I thought it was like uncle in the sense of like, oh, it's a close family friend.
No, I wondered about that. I at least the Wikipedia synopsis describes her as her cousin. I also think it's more likely just on the basis it's a small town.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm. But what I love about the children playing scenes is that it is a heightening, and what I like about it is that it's this heightening of the tensions that are happening with the adults in their community.
It's a direct reflection of the behaviours, words and actions that they're seeing their parents. Everybody knows what parents are.
I know what parents are. They're like parents, but plants.
Not where I thought you were going with that, for sure. They're seeing their parents play out, and they're using the same vocabulary. And as a byproduct of that, all of their games are violent. Mm-hmm. Even when they're solidifying their friendship, she's pricking their fingers with sharp bits of things to make blood pacts. Like, all of it is got some element of violence or harm. Or
There is some explicit cruelty, especially against animals, committed by children in this film. But
even when they're just throwing flour, it's framed like a gorilla attack.
Yeah.
Most of the times they're throwing stones, like they could literally injure each other severely. But there is also this scene, multiple scenes in the school where we're shown that they're given a very nationalistic education, particularly centered around the cult of personality of Harry Bolte, who was the Prime Minister of Victoria at the time. And I'm not going to spoil, there's a scene that happens quite late in the film, but I looked up Bolte's platform. And one of his main, like, policy prescriptions was that he was a huge proponent of the death penalty. So again, but you know, if you think about a scene that might that happens later in the film that evokes that, you know, there might be a parallel there.
And evokes other things.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to describe
that scene
anything.
Is multi-layered.
Yeah.
And his other policy was killing wabbits. He's very much the Elmer Fudd of Australian prime ministers.
Genuinely, what do you want to do as premier? Kill rabbits and kill humans.
Just killing in general. I'm all for it. Just the overt nationalism of this film made me think of a specific section, another film that we've covered, The Cars That Ate Paris.
Yeah.
Another Australian film set in an isolated Australian town. It's much more stylized and non-realist than this, but just the idea that in these isolated communities you cling to nationalism, and at its most extreme, it is extremely powerful to watch, but also, you know, obviously very depressing.
And I think that setting that type of film with that kind of political overlaying in a rural town, you see the same with like the kind of trope of small town, we ain't from round here, that kind of thing, where it's like I don't necessarily mean in the political sense, but in the sense that a communist family that get ostracized and sort of driven out by Celia's dad and the fascist policeman, they're brand new to the area. You see them moving in at the beginning. They're not part of this tight-knit community that's full of family members and things like that. So part of me wonders, yes, they're driven out because it's revealed that they're communists and it's a very nationalist community, but if they weren't communist, would something else have been found that was against them?
But I think it's also significant that they're driven out of the communist community as well, which I think is a really interesting detail. It's that adults are in this mindset.
Yeah. If you're not 100% us, you're not us at all.
Yeah, so even this communist party of this area is shown to be extremely close-minded and petty, rather than interested in the bigger ideas that Alice and Evan seem to be. And you could say that it's naivety because they've just come to this town and they don't know how these things are done. But I think it is really interesting that they're shunned by even the people that share their leanings. And I don't think this film is apolitical. I think this film is extremely critical of nationalism and right-wing politics. But I think it does also say something very interesting about all power structures.
Mm. But I also think that the Tanners are shown to be quite conscientious. How do you say?
Conscientious.
It's impossible. Conscientious. Oh, that's better. I do think that the Tanners are shown to be quite conscientious socialists. Like, I don't get a sense that they would be on board with the extent of the crimes of Stalinism. Were they aware of them? Which a lot of English-speaking communists in the 1950s weren't.
Well, she references that because they criticise her for not being pro-Soviet enough. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, I'm not pro-Stalin.
That's exactly the point then. It's like that they are, you know, ideologically pro a socialist economy, but they're not pro-Stalinist, whereas very often communist parties or institutions that call themselves communist are, especially at the time, communist in the sense of we're allied with the Red Bloc of the Cold War. So yeah, there's a difference there.
Can we just say that Murgatroyd is a great name for a rabbit?
It's a great name for anything, but especially a rabbit.
I thought it was a specific reference to something.
Me too. That's what I thought. Maybe it was because she... So for context, I don't know if we've said, the film opens up with Celia happening across her grandmother's body, who has passed away, I think, in her sleep. That's the impression that I got. And that's kind of the opening scene. So you immediately see that this child has just experienced some trauma. And as it comes out that she's had an extremely close bond with this grandmother who's almost been her best friend. And she then sees her grandmother at different points in the film. It's a recurring motif. Her grandmother was a communist, I think, or at the very least, left wing.
I think she was left wing, possibly, you know, suffragette.
Yeah, there's basically, she has a selection of books.
Yes.
And one of them, I think, is Lenin.
At a time where the distinctions between left and right were, if not less pronounced, less important to how everyone viewed you.
Exactly. But, point
what I think is important about her books is that they're fundamentally like the core theory of Marxist-Leninist or
Marxism.
Like,
I remember the books were Marxist. Mm-hmm. But my point more being that I thought Murgatroyd was a name she'd seen in one of her grandmother's books and pulled out. So I was like, Murgatroyd, that famous left-wing politician? Activist? I don't know. It turns out, what did you say Murgatroyd is?
I think it's an old surname, but it's also it's part of the catchphrase of a cartoon character that turned up in the 50s.
Okay.
Yeah,
but I don't know how...
Yeah. It's much less political than I thought it was. I was like, Celia, you left-wing little 8-year-old.
It sounded like a Transformers name, but obviously it's in the 50s, so it couldn't.
Well, I mean, if her grandmother was left-wing and living with them, it brings a whole... I hadn't considered while watching it, it's not until the plot develops, the reason why the father is so adamant about disposing all evidence of his mother or mother-in-law, I'm not sure which. I'm pretty sure it's his mother-in-law, because the policeman never factors into the conversations about the mother.
Yeah, I think it's about his mother-in-law.
And so burning and disposing of any evidence that his mother-in-law was this left-winger and that he has this stuff still in his house at a time of rabid anti-communism and anti-socialism, it becomes extremely dark, and it's a mirror of these things that, from my perspective at least, we know a lot more about happening in America.
Mm. Well, you know, the act of book burning is clearly evocative of very famous multiple book burnings that have been committed by far-right parties that didn't only include left-wing theory, but also included like queer medical research.
Books by Jews.
Yeah, exactly. So much progress has been lost in book burnings, and this film is clearly evoking that. There is something, although we're talking so much about the film's historical context, there is something about this film that, although it's set in the 50s, it's so distinctly an 80s film. Just the framing you know, kids roaming around unsupervised, having adventures. It's so...
I will say that, so to paint you a visual picture, Celia is a sort of skinny blonde kid. I think she's 8 or 9. Murgatroyd is the biggest fuck-off bunny I've ever seen in my entire life. He's like the size of her, and she carries him like a baby for 50% of the film. She sprints away from genuine danger whilst cuddling this enormous bunny in her arms. And not only that, is when she's doing too many naughty things or fighting battles or whatever, and she can't hold the bunny, she gives it to an even smaller child, the smallest child of their group, who genuinely can't even hold the weight of this enormous rabbit.
You can only surmise that Murgatroyd is 90% fluff, 10% skin.
And
I don't think Celia cuts Murgatroyd's hair regularly.
I don't think so either, but it's
not that she
really
gets a chance.
She's got much more important things on her mind. But honestly, it's quite a funny image, because it is that idea that, like, when a kid has a favourite toy or pet or something, there is no separating that child from that thing. And I think whilst it's a really quite an amusing image when she's doing certain things while sort of holding this enormous rabbit over her shoulder or whatever, it does make her relationship with that rabbit incredibly intimate and attached, and it provides a great plot arc without trying to spoil it too much.
Yeah. I think that Celia's obsession with the Hobbyars in particular, it really highlights her views on the way that adults act and the way that, without thinking, they act as, I use the word homogenous to describe Wook and his group, and the idea of a faceless evil with multiple bodies, it's something that would be very, very scary to a young child. And it was scary to this 26-year-old man, but this idea of a rabid group acting instinctively and enacting violence, I think that by highlighting the preoccupation with that behaviour through the fairy tale means that when it is replicated by the children, the perception of violence has so many layers to it, and I think that's a really interesting achievement of this film. It's a very different view on perspective than the previous two films we've discussed, but it really, if not making it totally from her perspective, you understand the way that she interprets things really well.
Do you think it's significant that one of the figures that she very, very explicitly views as a Hobbyer, and bearing in mind you've just mentioned it's kind of a visually homogenous group of evil, she views as pretty much the only uniformed character.
You're talking about the policeman?
Yeah.
Her uncle?
Yeah.
Who presumably she knows very well on a personal
bit. Yeah, you'd imagine. And yet, because he is the one who enacts government law as a homogenous group with other policemen, especially as she gets to watch the news and stuff with her parents, so she sees other policemen doing similar things, taking away rabbits, X, Y, Z. And then when he does that, he is no longer her uncle. He is that homogenous group of evil. And it's almost as a result of his duties as a policeman, as this homogenous uniformed group, that makes him into the Hobbyer physically.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that the significance of calling him in particular, but also, I mean, she also refers to her father as a Hobbyer at one point, but not...
she doesn't see him as a Hobbyer. Like, there's a very surreal moment where he actually turns into this kind of slimy blue creature.
Doesn't her grandmother turn into one very briefly? Or is it she thinks it's her grandmother and one turns up at the window?
Yeah, so she thinks she hears her then deceased grandmother scratching at the window to be let in, goes to the window, and it's actually a Hobbyer, like, tricking her into opening the window.
And she also draws Hobbyer features onto the photograph of the premiere. I do really like the idea, though, the idea that the essentially mid-level government official is this embodiment of ultimate evil is hilarious to me.
Also that he's, you know, viewed with such... it's a cult of personality, right? Fundamentally, and he's not even the leader of the whole country.
I think that's really powerful, but also very, very funny.
And it's very in keeping with the fact it's from a child's perspective, and it's that idea that a child's world is so much smaller just because they've experienced so many less people. So if he is the premier of the province. You know, that's the province she lives in. She's probably not gone much further than that. That's her world. So as far as she's concerned, he's the big bad evil.
Well, when the Tanners eventually move, what really struck me was when you're a child, especially a child in a small, fairly isolated community, when a family leaves that community, that is a significant proportion of the people you know no longer existing. And it makes it so much more heartbreaking. I think that the film really powerfully communicates that. I like this film, but we've talked about it for long enough. This film is luckily available to stream on Prime Video and BFI Player.
Excellent.
So let's move on to our final film? Question mark.
Has Jade been cheeky with her film
Has
picks?
Has Jade been
Find
a
out.
Naughty boy?
Don't conflate me with Kevin.
Plenty of room.
For what?
A children's bedroom. We used to have a life.
Now we have each other.
The insidious, venomous slither of life.
I want to have a child. With you.
Everything's okay!
Okay, so our final pick for this episode is Yerma, which is a recording of a production directed by Simon Stone in 2017, adapted from Federico García Lorca's play, which was published and then performed in 1934. That's correct, 1934. So the synopsis is, a woman is driven to the unthinkable by her desperate desire to have a child in Simon Stone's radical production of Lorca's achingly powerful masterpiece. I mean, wherever you got the synopsis from, Charlie loves the production.
Yeah, it's. I'm pretty sure.
Was it a review?
No, I think it's a synopsis from The Young Vic.
Oh, that makes National sense. Theatre that Live. Makes sense. It was particularly complimentary rather than objective. But I think for good reason.
I am inclined to agree. The Letterboxd title is National Theatre Live : Yerma.
Yes, I mean, there have been. It's a very old, very famous play, so there have been countless productions. But this one in particular, I saw it. And when I say it, I mean the filmed version of it in lockdown. And it stuck with me for a very long time. And to defend the fact that it's not really a film, it's a play that has been filmed. There are a lot of themes in it and a lot of parallels that I really wanted to talk about and I think are really interesting to talk about, which has a slightly different perspective due to the distinctive absence of a child in this play. But this particular version that I thought was relevant to us talking about it on a film podcast is, firstly, it is filmed and portrayed for viewing online. It's not just a recording. Someone set up a camera at the back of a theatre.
It's to be viewed in a cinema.
Yeah, it was, you know, streamed, I guess?
Yeah. Screened.
Screened.
Screened and streamed.
And streamed. In a cinema, it has close-ups, different angles, all of the things that you would recognise from a cinematic viewing.
Yeah, there is a care put into the
filming aspects of it. And more than that, I think, and this is what I said sort of off mic earlier as well, that I think performances like this and performances in a theatre can historically be a little bit exclusionary. You know, you either manage to get a ticket, which can be quite expensive, and you see it, and if you don't see that, you miss it. And additionally, some people aren't inclined to go to the theatre. It's maybe not someone's first thought if they aren't sort of involved in drama or theatre or the dramatic arts as a hobby or as a profession.
Or they don't live in London.
Or they don't live in London because it's not that accessible. For me, the fact that so much care was put into the filming of it and other things that have been shown at theatres in London, which has then been screened in cinemas and put online for consumption, I think is making theatre more accessible. It's making it more consumable. And I think this podcast is all about making media more accessible and consumable.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I don't think that we need to go into the level of detail put into the camera work to justify this as a film. As far as I'm concerned, point a camera at something, you record it, and then you publish it, that's a film. There are theatrically released films that are static single shots, not moving, and those are films. What distinguishes this from those is that it's obviously part of a run, and it was performed in front of a live audience. But yeah, as far as the recording of it is concerned, it fits within the purview of the podcast perfectly.
The recording is incidental, but it's enough. I will say that my reservation about Jade choosing this film wasn't to do with it being a very well-filmed version of a theatrical play. It was more that would anyone be able to watch it or access it?
Mm. My only defence of that is that some of the films put forward previously on the podcast are relatively inaccessible.
It's more accessible than half of my picks.
Yeah, so to be honest, if Francesco can put forward some of his, yeah, I can put forward this.
No, but this, we're going to get to accessibility later, but this film is streamable, and it's available.
And I also think it does add a different layer to our conversation, because our conversation has been quite focused, obviously, on motherhood and relationships and familial relationships, but it has focused a lot on children, mm-hmm, and children that have either through nature or nurture committed Charlie's favourite word, atrocities. Yay! But in this case, actually, that's not the case, because the entire driving premise of this plot is the distinct lack of a child.
Yes.
I very quickly wanted to say that one of the big reasons that I chose this was because I felt that the character originally called Yerma in Lorca's play, but actually just referred to as her. She's not given a name.
Yeah, she's credited as her, you're right.
Yeah, in Simon Stone's version. But I might just call her Yerma for the sake of that being quite difficult to say in conversation.
Or you could call her Billy Piper.
Yeah. I could call her Billy Piper, because Billy Piper is incredible in this.
And won every single award. That is not an exaggeration.
Every award that was up for grabs that year,
she won. And I don't know of any other time that that's happened.
And I think that's totally fair play, because she was incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I must say, I think because I haven't followed theatre for a few years, and I just don't follow theatre in general or TV. I mostly knew her as, I only knew her as one of the Doctor's assistants in Doctor Who during the David Tennant run.
Her name is Rose Tyler.
Yeah.
And she's amazing with David Tennant.
Yeah, companions, not assistants, sorry, whatever. But, you know.
One of the assistants. She's Rose Tyler.
Yeah, but that's what I knew her for.
Rose Tyler.
Yeah, so I never see her performing anything good. And.
I think Charlie might slap you.
No. I'm going to phone up Paxton.
No, the David Tennant section of Doctor Who is my favourite by a mile. Haven't seen it in a few years. I don't remember the name of the character. She was kind of a discovery for me, because I only knew her as, you know, her role in Doctor Who. Because I guess she performs more in theatre than she does
underrated for so many years, I would say.
Yeah.
Although I've just realised I didn't actually say my original point for choosing the
We went on a Billy Piper tangent.
We went on a Billy Piper tangent.
Which we are keeping in.
Which I'm happy to have, because I love a tangent about Billy Piper. But my point was that her character as Yerma, or her in this version, in comparison to Tilda Swinton's character of Eva, I think is absolutely fascinating, because they both start from very similar places. They are both writers. I'm pretty sure Eva is a travel writer or publisher. Mm-hmm. And Yerma, or Billy Piper's character, is a blogger, writer, journalist, amalgamation of those things.
She's an editor in a magazine?
A blogger.
And she has a successful sort of lifestyle or memoir blog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, that develops into other things
it becomes kind of confessional.
Exactly. And they start from this place. They're both left-wing writers in a great relationship they're very, very happy with. And then that moves into the next stage of kids. In Eva's case, it results in a child that she can't feel a maternal connection to, that basically consumes her life because of the way that this child terrorizes her and eventually leads to the dissolution of her relationship. As almost a direct mirror image of that, Billy Piper's character of Yerma, or her, just cannot have a child. And that absence of a child is what terrorizes her and sends her down a path of dissolving her relationships, and particularly her marriage. And both of these women end up completely isolated. And yes, they don't conclude in the same way. And obviously the plot is very different due to that distinct lack of a child. But I think that progression of motherhood, or the absence of motherhood, is really, really interesting.
I think you're right, but I think that on a deeper level, if we go back to Eva, I think that the absence of motherhood does define her.
Yeah, of the nurturing mother.
Despite having a child, she finds herself unable to be what society expects a mother to be.
Yeah.
And likewise, except more literally, she doesn't have a child.
And I mean, in Lorca's original play, Yerma, which... Yerma means barren in Spanish, so that's, it's very obvious signalling there that nothing's going to be growing.
It's a weirder thing to call your child in 2017.
Yes, but in Lorca's original version, obviously it's much older, it's...
34.
34.
Yeah.
And the context of her wanting a child is more social pressure, honor, also a kind of religious duty. So it is much more focused on societal pressure and expectation, whereas it is a different lens when they do the modern adaptation of it. So it's almost more paralleled there.
Although, I think the modern adaptation, I think it leaves it ambiguous, but it does comment on that as a possible source, yeah. right? Because I think another parallel between her and Eva is not only what you described, but the fact that where they start is not only as writers, but also as very idealistic, liberal-leaning, you know, progressive people who then, through their career achievements, entered this bourgeois upper class environment in the form of buying a new house and having this like just being thrown into this very like upper class in the case of Kevin Suburban, in the case of, you know, Yerma, more London like loft style apartment.
It's Marylebone, right?
Marylebone,
you know,
yeah.
it's not a loft, it's a house with three floors.
It's a house with three floors in Marylebone.
And a garden.
Okay, that doesn't make sense.
They're loaded.
That's why it makes sense.
Yeah.
They don't use it until years after they've moved in.
Yeah, there are scenes with like some astroturf on the stage. Whatever. But, you know, it's also this class shift. And the fact that both of the husbands, both Franklin and John, seem to be these, you know, fairly liberal, but also like very corporatized or very job driven, quite conservatively minded people. You know, she has that type of influence in her life. And there are several comments in Yerma the play about how it does seem like she's, according to her husband, she's being assuaged by the bourgeois lifestyle, and she now yearns for, you know, a nuclear, you know, heteronormative family. There are also moments of clear pressure from her family and peers, like when she speaks to Victor near the beginning and she's like, oh, we're trying for a child, and it's like, it's about time. Or when she's speaking to her mother or her sister who's just popping a child every like 3 minutes.
And her children are terrible.
Yeah.
She has a Kevin.
Yeah. So why
does she?
Her sister has a Kevin because he won't stop crying.
He'll only cry around. Yeah.
So on the side, I imagine we don't need to talk about Kevin. Wait, no.
We've been talking about Kevin for so long.
On the side, I imagine we need to talk about Kevin subplot happening with Yerma's sister.
That's terrifying.
So I guess the point is, whereas in the original Lorcas, it's more of a institutional Christian conservative type of pressure directly telling her that you're married, you're supposed to have a child. Here, it's more of like a broader social malaise that like, oh, she's approaching 35 and everyone around her is having children. She probably thinks that's what she's supposed to do. And this idea turns into an obsession.
The one thing I will say that I know is a modern addition to the play and one that I found the most difficult to watch aspects of it, the fact that it's alluded to quite a few times that she had an abortion when she was 23, and we meet her ex-boyfriend Victor, who you kind of figure out was the partner she was with at the time that she had the abortion. That addition for me makes everything make more sense. It makes the fact that she knows at one point in her life she was able to conceive, and she did conceive. And from her conversations with Victor, he wanted her to keep the child.
I think the film is very, very careful not to put blame on her for having an abortion, not to frame her choice of having an abortion as the wrong choice. I say the film, you know, the text, the play, whatever this is.
The fact that you're calling it a film shows that it is a film.
Yeah. But it is certain that there is a certain subtext there where she's blaming herself for having the abortion because she's now regretting wanting something that, you know, she could have had in the past. I don't think it's the argument that the play is making, because they explicitly say it in a dialogue that, no, at the time when you were 23, you weren't able to have a child. You weren't supposed to have a child. You want it now because you're settled, you're rich, you've got a house and a husband and all of that. So I just wanted to clarify, because there is some subtext in this play that could be misconstrued as being anti-choice, but I don't think that the play is.
Oh no, it's absolutely not. I think what it is it's exploring the kind of turbulent mental state of her not having thought much of the abortion at the time, and then now she is ready to have a child and can't, almost being haunted. I mean, literally being haunted by this imaginary figure of what that child could have been. And I don't think, yeah, I completely agree. It's not in any way anti-abortion, but what it is doing is it's exploring the idea of a what if, and the idea that she's haunted by that, and that's not criticizing her choice at all. It's just exploring that mental state that she might have ended up in.
And that's embodied by her reconnection with her ex-boyfriend Victor, and the fact that they become friends and co-workers will only remind her of the decision she made back then.
Yeah.
And I think if the... I'm doing it now, same film. If this play slash film is laying the blame on anyone, I would argue it's kind of doing it on John and the mother to a lesser extent for not being able to properly support someone dealing with the implications of her infertility.
Yeah, I think so too. I think she's left a lot of the time to spiral internally and nobody's really listening to her. I mean, the other parallel is that in We Need to Talk About Kevin, John C. Reilly / Franklin is very emotionally unavailable for her and isn't supportive. He might be there sort of physically, but he isn't present with her in her experiences with Kevin. And in this instance, it's much more explicit. John works away a lot. He is physically not there for her. And whilst when he is home for short periods of time, he's trying to be emotionally available for her, it's not enough. And those long stretches when she's by herself, she's left to her own devices, she's left to her own thoughts, and especially when she's pouring everything out into a blog, it just allows her to spiral without much intervention.
Her closest friend appears to be a fairly younger co-worker.
Mm.
And sure, that's economy of characters, but also if that, considering that is the only non-family member female friend she seems to have, and the only friend other than her ex-boyfriend who is also a co-worker, shows someone who is extremely isolated.
And I think isolation is one of the biggest themes that have come out of both Yerma and We Need to Talk About Kevin, the fact that when you aren't fitting into the traditional stereotype of motherhood, whether that's because you can't conceive or because you've conceived and you can't feel that connection, you are then isolated and you're ostracized. And it's also shown in Yerma when she gets a bit of online pushback. There's a comment where Victor, he says, you know, are you on Facebook? And she says, oh no, I've left that. There were too many trolls, too much backlash, because she is putting her public life on these blogs. And that's just enforcing that isolation. She can't keep in contact with people and she can't connect with people even online because of the isolation that it's pushing her into.
That felt very real watching that. I think the way that it takes the core of Lorca's story and updates it into this very specific setting, it is fairly seamless. I will say, if I have any gripe with this version, it's that a lot of the pop culture references are very, very current to 2017.
Yeah, they are.
To an extent that from 2022, it feels deliberate and self-conscious rather than seamless. And I don't remember thinking that at the time when I first watched, because I watched it when it first screened in 2017. That's just a small thing about updating. Everything else, I think, works very well, even 5 years later. Did either of you feel during the transitions, every time you got one that was 2 years later or 6 months later, like you were receiving a punch to the gut?
Yeah.
Because they're such severe time jumps.
This is something I wanted to mention. Just overall, this play is incredibly difficult to sit through. Like, I was fortunate that I was watching it in streaming and not live, so I could take breaks in between scenes, because whereas something like poetry is very emotionally draining because of how tragic it is, this is just punching the gut after punching the gut. And yes, you're right, there are these like title card transitions that show the flow of time, and it spans years and years and years and years, which really like helps put a lot of the character relations into perspective as well. Like the way that some characters change or some their perspectives change.
Really, all the characters meet or reconnect.
Yeah.
And then cut to them being the best of friends. For example, like, it's very significant with Victor. Not only do you have a big time cut after he and Yerma reconnect, but also when he first meets John, it's quite awkward. Time jump, he's at their wedding and they seem to be pals.
I also think it helps make sense of the fact her sister's popping them out like nobody's business, because there's big time jumps. Because if there weren't those time jumps, it would make no medical sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, that she'd even give birth to one if it was just...
yeah.
Unless she was, like, heavily pregnant at the beginning.
But speaking of the said characters, you were commenting saying earlier about how they're completely unhelpful and they are just detrimental to our mental health. There is a point in the second half of the play where a lot of them start sort of becoming the voice of reason and start, you know, telling it as it is or telling her she needs therapy, etc. But if you put in the framing of how many years this spans, it's too little too late.
Yeah,
like, it's
definitely
presumed that they spent years and years and years pressuring her into having a child or just dismissing her concerns. And once her mental health anguish externalizes in more extreme ways, they're like, oh, now all of a sudden I'm gonna tell you what to do and I'm gonna tell you to seek therapy.
I don't know if people were pressuring it, because the mother, I don't think the mother is very anti-child. It's almost her neglect makes her want to have a child despite her mother.
Yeah, sorry, I don't think it's direct pressure like it is in the Lorca play. I think it's more what I described earlier, like all these like micro behaviors by the people around her
that
kind of influence, you know, her shape her desires. And there is a point in the play where her husband basically tells her, you never wanted a child, and all of a sudden you want it. It's not your choice. But by that point, it's become her choice. She's internalized it so deeply, it's become who she is. So, yeah.
Jade.
Yeah.
Would you like to implore our listeners about why they should watch this version of Yerma?
Of course, Charlie. I'd be more than happy to. So, I mean, if we're just going to very basic, Billy Piper is sensational, but not only Billy Piper, the rest of the cast is sensational.
Yes.
But yeah, the cast is sensational. It's a really interesting visual experience. So it's in Traverse in a big glass box. Traverse being audience on two sides of the box, like a train track. Mm. Don't know why that came to me.
I've always thought of it more like a catwalk.
That's a much nicer way of putting it. Yeah, like a massive catwalk in a glass box. So visually and performance-wise, it's stunning. But more than that, it is a hard emotional watch. Like Francesco says, don't go into it if you're not having a great day or you're looking for something light. But ultimately, I think it's a really, really interesting, meaty, just beautifully done performance of a very old play. And I think if you are looking at We Need to Talk About Kevin from the angle of motherhood and isolation and familial relationships, it's a really, really interesting watch. And it also veers away from the kind of child, disturbed children aspect of it. So if you find children creepy, then this is a play for you, because there's absolutely no kids in it except for a brief appearance from one of Mary's 1,000 children.
And he's a little cute baby.
Yeah. He's not evil yet.
It'll happen. All right. You can access this via a Drama Online account, which if you're a student, your institution is likely to have. And you can also stream it on National Theatre at Home. And hopefully they will come out with a DVD of it at some point. Also, read the Lorca play. Pretty good.
Yeah, or read the Simon Stone text. I'm sure it's been published.
Yeah, it has. Yeah. You can read any of the texts if you're also a paper person as well as a screen person.
What are we talking about? Our listeners don't read.
Our listeners can't read. It's much easier to find the script than it is to watch the play.
Yeah.
That tends to be the case.
And I know, but I think it's stupid.
And to be honest, if you're just interested in, you want to put a visual image, like I do with any film that I'm interested in watching, watch the trailer. You can find that on YouTube and you can just kind of see what it might have looked like if you wanted to put a couple of faces to names and things like that.
And a lot of great interviews with the team and cast behind it.
Mm.
It's really good. So, to wrap up quickly, If We Need to Talk About Kevin is a horrible main course that gives you food poisoning. What is dessert?
I think dessert is Celia, because I think it's a nice contrast while still being thematically in keeping with it. I think that for me, if I watched either poetry or Yerma as course with it, I would feel a bit overwhelmed. Celia is a little bit more lighthearted, but it's an interesting take on it. And it in the same way that a dessert's like a palate cleanser, it goes with the main meal, but you're not having the same thing again. If it's a burger, you're not having a sweet version of a burger, you know?
Yeah.
You're having ice cream.
Yeah, poetry is definitely, if you're looking something with a plot, very close to We Need to Talk About Kevin, but a drastically different style, a style that is more detached and quiet and maybe more realist and, you know, less subjective. I think, oh God, like, yeah, there is no dessert
in
this episode.
Can I just say
that
if you had poetry as the dessert, it would be like We Need to Talk About Kevin as the risotto, and that's like having rice pudding straight after a risotto, because it's a similar thing, but like a very different vibe.
See, yeah. I'm going to pick poetry. country.
Really? You want rice pudding after risotto?
Well, look, the dessert thing is just nicer than the double bill question. The whole point of changing the double bill question is because everyone took it too literally, and the exact same thing is happening. So the reason why I'd say poetry is my chosen comparison piece out of the three we've discussed is that it takes a very horrific story and takes a lot of the Hollywood sheen off of some of the characters and some of the circumstances. And not that Lynn Ramsey is a particularly cliche filmmaker. I think she's extremely talented and I really appreciate the film. But I think that the banality, as we talked about before, and the mundanity of poetry really makes it a wonderful dessert.
Mm-hmm. I think all three really speak to different aspects of the title pick here. I think poetry expands on the line of the crimes of the mother or the crimes of the father, if you will, when a child commits atrocity, as Charlie would put it. Celia maybe expands more on the nature versus nurture themes, in that it's very explicitly about how this child's psyche is being shaped by her environment. And Yerma, I don't think I need to make any more of a case than what you, Jade, said earlier, but it's, you know, more about the idea of motherhood in and of itself, and maybe about, you know, if you're interested in Eva's character specifically, she has very little in common with Mija as a character. Mm. So if you're less interested in the Kevin stuff and the, you know, horrible child stuff, and you're more interested in this very centered female perspective and a mother's perspective, although in a warped way in the case of Yerma, then definitely Yerma is, you know, the pick you want to go with.
All right, well, that's all from us this episode. Thank you, Jade, for coming on and being a wonderful guest, as well as our esteemed producer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Molecule for our artwork. If you want to follow us on social media, our handles are at BCU Watch Pod on Twitter and at BCU Watch Podcast on Instagram. Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.
Bye.